From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, this is Latino USA. I'm Daisy Rosario, in for Maria Hinojosa.
Well, when I was a child, I was in foster care. I was in the foster system. And that was almost like my escape from reality. I started gravitating towards comic books. And I've just been a nerd ever since.
The things we love can help us through the hard times and help us define who we are. But sometimes it also feels like the things we love don't love us back.
As a kid, pretty much any character who wasn't a white guy, and even a lot of the white guys, were stereotypes. At one point, there were more black boxers in fighting games than there were black main characters in every other video game.
Today, diversity in the world of geeks, from video games and comic books to science fiction and fantasy. We hear directly from fans and creators about what they love and why they're willing to fight for it. Stay with us. Hey, since you're listening to this especially geeky episode of Latino USA, I think you'll really like NPR's newest podcast, Hidden Brain. On the latest episode, Shankar Vedantam looks at the consequences of near misses and the surprising way these losses can motivate us. Plus, country singer Kacey Musgraves joined Shankar to talk about her new album and play a game of mad scientist. So don't miss it. Listen now on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Daisy Rosario, in for Maria Hinojosa. Now, I don't know about you, but I am a proud geek. I love to learn about space. I see superhero movies on opening weekend, and quite honestly, if you could have seen me recently at a train museum, you would have thought I was a child on Christmas and not a professional woman in her 30s. So basically, I am a nerd. And I am not the only one. On today's show, we are exploring the world I call geekdom through some of its most well-known aspects, like comic books, fantasy, and science fiction. And we start with video games, because video games are big business. 67% of American households play video games. And while you might think of these games as child's play, most gamers are actually adults. The average age of gamers is 34 years old. But while all kinds of people play games, it can still be hard to find diverse characters in the games. About 3% of video game characters can be identified as Latino. That's 3. And of that 3%, only 5% of those are characters that you can actually use to play. These statistics come from a study published in the journal New Media and Society in 2009. Now, the numbers are a few years old, but the dialogue around diversity in games has been increasing over the years. So I reached out to a few people who love games to talk about the issue.
Video games for me, I started playing as a kid because, you know, they all came out around that time with Nintendo and Super Nintendo.
This is Mary Lourdes. She's a comedy writer and former co-host of the video game podcast Unlimited Lives. Mary loves games. She loves the sense of play and all the different ways that we use games.
When I'm on the subway and I just need to, like, kill a moment and, like, not think about anything, I could play, like, a phone game. Or I can play a game that I think about for, like, days because it's, like, a long adventure game that I'm, like, living in another world. Or I could go to a party and we'll, like, play, like, a karaoke game, you know? So it really is just something that's, like, become part of what I do and what I think about.
Even though Mary has loved games her whole life, she's still surprised by certain things.
I didn't realize how much I have a different experience from men when I play games and how much that shapes what I want to play.
Mary says she normally shies away from playing open format, large world games online because that means you'll have to interact with other online players. Given the option, she'll play a game offline and just follow the story.
We won't survive long out in the open like this. Let's get inside the walls.
When the beta version of a new game called Destiny was released last year, Mary decided to try playing it online so she'd be ready to talk about it for her podcast. At first, it was great. She had really positive interactions with other players. That changed when her avatar started roaming around a marketplace area.
And this guy kept following me around because I was playing as a woman. And, like, he would make his character kneel so that his head was in my character's rear end.
Mary did not enjoy it. She says she's used to certain things. For example, playing online, everyone gets called names. Male, female, doesn't matter. That's something she knows and accepts.
But what I realized struck me the most is that I play games for the same reason that men do. I want to escape my reality. But even when I'm playing games, I can never escape the fact that I'm a woman. Like, I just can't get away from it. And it bums me out because it's like, we're all here for the same thing.
But being there for the same reasons doesn't mean everyone has the same experience.
It's the first time I realized, like, oh, I'm not only am I living in a different world in my life, I'm living in a different world in games.
Everyone I've known throughout my entire life growing up has played video games.
David Brothers is a former comic book journalist who now works at Image Comics. He also started playing video games as a kid. He noticed a lack of diversity that went beyond the male-female divide.
As a kid, pretty much any character who wasn't a white guy, and even a lot of the white guys, were stereotypes. So it led to a situation where, for example, at one point there were more black boxers in fighting games than there were black main characters in every other video game.
David says he thinks video games aren't diverse for a few reasons. One is that companies are hesitant to put out characters from different communities because they're afraid they'll get them wrong. Or that those games just plain won't make money.
If a game comes out and it's got a lady as a hero and then it doesn't sell any copies, they're like, oh, well, it must be because there was a woman and guys don't want to play as women. But women play video games. Like, you know, I grew up playing video games with my cousin and she's definitely a lady.
In fact, it's not just ladies like David's cousin who play video games. A lot of women do. According to the Entertainment Software Rating Board, 40% of gamers are women. Though there are differences of gender, race, and ethnicity, David says there are certain things that we all understand.
Everyone knows what it's like to fear losing a parent or to fear being a bad parent even, or even just waking up and like having a bad day and stubbing your toe and, you know, cussing out an ottoman or something like that. All of our experiences are relatable as long as you deliver them in a way that we can recognize what's going on.
And for him, this is part of the magic of video games.
You're essentially living someone else's story. And this is as true of role-playing games where, you know, you're the hero in a small town and you go out and slay the evil king and become king. Or even sports games. I play a lot of NBA 2K14, which is just NBA basketball. And that's it. You can create a player or you can play as the actual players. Here's Paul. After the made shot from Russia, you can see the eye contact. But while you're playing those games, it's totally a you sink into the game. It becomes your reality.
And sometimes living someone else's story can make you deal with your own.
There is a game called Papa and Yo.
It's Papa and Yo.
But it was created by a developer, and it's essentially about the developer's relationship with his father as a kid. His father was scary and abusive, but also very loving and supportive at the same time.
The game follows a little boy named Kiko and his best friend, Monster. Monster is addicted to frogs, and when he eats them, his personality grows violent and abusive. But Kiko still loves Monster and wants to save him.
I've been playing that game very slowly over the past few years because just the father issues in it are so real and so resonant that it's hard to take for very long. It's fun, it's excellent, but it's harrowing on a very personal level for me. And it's been one of my favorite games just because of that.
That game, Papo Io, was created by this guy.
My name is Vander Caballero. I'm creative director and presidente of Minority Media.
Though he now runs Minority Media in Montreal, Vander grew up in Colombia. He says his hard childhood made video games very important to him. That is, until he hit his teens and found girls.
And then I abandoned games for a bit. And I remember one night I was walking with a girlfriend of mine and we were walking in front of Blockbuster and I saw Mario in 64 and suddenly went, wow, that's 3D graphics.
So Vander studied industrial design. There weren't video game programs at the time, though that has changed. He says that while you might not see it reflected in the games, it's not a secret to the companies who's playing the games.
They're really aware, big companies are really aware of who's playing those games.
This awareness even led to work for Vander at some well-known video game companies, like Electronic Arts or EA.
My first job at EA was working for FIFA.
FIFA, as in football or soccer? The game features real teams and players from around the world.
I was an art director for FIFA, and they were looking for people with that experience from another cultural point of view. And that it was really valuable. So we were a multicultural team when we were working on FIFA, and it was amazing. So we're really aware of who's playing the game, so for who are we building games for.
But not every experience is as multicultural as working on a game about international soccer teams. Take what happened when he worked on the game Army of Two.
There was a moment that we were designing the two characters. A bunch of guys were pushing to be Caucasians, and I said, like, no, if both heroes are Caucasians, I'm leaving. And then I was able to put an immigrant character, Tyson Rios, in the game.
After 8 years working for the big companies, Vander started Minority Media, precisely so he could make games like Papoillo. The game got great reviews. Sometimes Vander hears from fans who, like David, see something of themselves in the game. One day, Vander even got a letter he never expected.
I received a letter from a dad, a single dad, who wrote to me saying, I love Papoillo because when I was playing, I realized how my kid felt when I screamed to him. And then I went, wow. I was not only able to touch the victims, but also the aggressors. I never thought I would be able to touch someone like my father.
And for Vander, that means everything.
It is so beautiful. I think right now as an artist, I could die. I accomplished what I wanted to accomplish.
Vander sees his success as a reason to be hopeful.
I'm the example that is changing, and it could change. We just need more time and more people who have the opportunity to be in position of power, being minorities, to influence the choices.
But getting diverse voices into those positions is a big challenge when people don't feel welcome. Mary Lourdes is a good example.
I mean, everything I hear about women in the industry is that they're not wanted, and it's extremely difficult. And I honestly shied away from it myself. I thought for a while that I was like, oh, well, I love video games. I could turn that into a career, especially like writing-wise. I would love to write video games. But just seeing, and this is kind of a shame because I think the more women involved, the better we would get for all women. But seeing the way women were treated, I was like, you know what? I don't need that. I don't want that part of my life.
It's a treatment that Mary says comes from fear. Not that she herself fully gets that.
I don't understand what the fear is, especially because you want women in your corner. Because those games all the time go to like court cases, or they get rulings against them that are like, you have to have labels so kids don't buy it. And who do you want in your corner is women and mothers. You know, I'm going to be a mother someday, and I like video games, and I'm going to like if my kids play video games. But not if you continually tell me that it's not a space for me.
Yet the online vitriol that so often greets requests for more diverse games proves that the fear is real, at least among some people. But whatever it is, it won't stop everyone from wanting something more. Here's David Brothers again.
Diversity doesn't take anything away. Like, you're not going to not get stories about white dudes anymore. You know, those are still going to exist. You just get those stories plus stories about, I don't know, gay men or Jewish women or First Nations peoples in Canada. You know, there's a lot I don't know, and I'm increasingly okay with that, but there's still a lot that I want to know. And the more people tell their stories, even just around me, like if I trip over a story or I find something, you know, it makes my life better to know what they've gone through as well.
Thanks to Mary Lourdes, David Brothers, and Vander Caballero for speaking with me for that story. For more information about them and everyone else you'll hear about today, visit our website, latinousa.org. You know, video games can be a great place to lose yourself, especially after a loss. After my father died, pretty much the only thing I wanted to do was play Super Mario Galaxy. It kept my brain busy and didn't require me to try and be social, because I wasn't ready to do that for a while. When we continue on Latino USA,
it was the first chance I really had to be myself, which is, I guess, kind of weird considering I was acting in character at the time.
We find out what this woman is so passionate about. And next, we learn more about what's going on with comic books. Stay with us.
We'll be right back.
Hey, if you're enjoying today's episode about diversity in geekdom, could you do us a favor and just go on iTunes and rate and review the show? It helps us find new listeners. Some of you have written really wonderful, amazing reviews, so thank you so much. But if you haven't done it yet, hey, why don't you join those people? Also, if you can, go to our website, latinousa.org, and click on the donate button. Every little penny helps us make episodes like this, where we hear from real people who are passionate about topics, voices that we don't necessarily always hear on the radio. That's something that we love to do, and it's always great when you can help us do it. Thanks so much.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from TIAA CREF, a global financial company dedicated to delivering financial outcomes that matter. TIAA CREF, created to serve, built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org. And Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at LumberLiquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Daisy Rosario, in for Maria Hinojosa. We're focusing on diversity in the world of geeky or nerdy things today, and we can't do that without talking about the publications that gave us superheroes like Superman, Wonder Woman, and Spider-Man. So face front, true believers, it's time to talk about comic books.
Cool. Oh, man,
what else did you get?
I got this.
So it's your first convention, right?
Yeah, this
How's
is my
it feel?
I feel like a little kid again.
Again, right?
This is my rebirth.
In the halls of the Javits Convention Center in New York City, two guys are nerding out.
And the spot with the wings! Oh, you don't want these? Oh, you want me to keep these?
Friends Angel Vega and Juan de los Santos are showing each other their stuff. We're at Special Edition New York City, a comic book convention, and they've been shopping for comics, superhero art, and action figures all day. So I had to ask Angel, who's your favorite superhero?
Spider-Man. I mean, New York City, I'm from New York, so he's my friendly neighborhood hero.
Angel has loved comics for years, but this is his first convention. Juan is more seasoned and is egging Angel on about his purchases. It's clear they've talked about what this day will be like for a while. Like many, Juan got into it as a kid.
Well, when I was a child, I was in foster care. I was in the foster system. And that was almost like my escape from reality. I started gravitating towards comic books. And I've just been a nerd ever since.
The idea of a savior really spoke to him.
When you find yourself just up against the wall, when you were boned, essentially, there would always be that magic man in a blue suit from the heavens that came to rescue you from that. And then Batman, for example, went through, I can relate to his story, and except I'm not fighting crime, and I'm not strong. But I get that. I get why he became who he became.
Even though Juan can relate to some heroes, it still surprises him that a well-known character would look like him. In 2011, Marvel created an alternate version of Spider-Man, who is Afro-Latino. Instead of Peter Parker, Ultimate Spider-Man is the story of Miles Morales, the Brooklyn-born son of an African-American dad and a Latina mom. But even Juan didn't have very high hopes.
I thought it wasn't going to move as much because he's Black and Spanish. That ain't going to move. But I'm glad that people embrace him. Fans embrace Miles as what for a superhero, for what he is, you know. Everything is it's just so well written. You're following him on his journey as he's learning, you're learning with him. It's refreshing.
And lifelong self-described nerds like Juan get to witness it.
It's intense to see all these races now. It's not just a white man sport anymore.
Juan and Angel aren't outliers. The convention crowd is hugely diverse in every way. Not only are Latinos and other people of color everywhere, but various LGBTQ couples walk hand in hand, all ages are represented, and a few people with disabilities are pulling off some impressive costumes. Yet the comic books themselves still seem marketed mostly to straight white men. But thanks to the internet, non-white fans are making themselves known in a way they couldn't before. Meanwhile, over in another hall, the longest line I've seen all day is for...
Very excited to be moderating this panel, reimagining a female superhero.
The room is packed.
My name is Ben Saunders. I'm a professor at the University of Oregon. I was hired to teach Shakespeare and early modern poetry. I got tenure, and I've been teaching comics ever since.
Fans like Cristela Rosa ask questions.
I asked if they had any opinions regarding just the general representation of not just women in general, but also women of color.
Cristela is Filipina, from Long Island.
So, like, growing up with comics, like, I love comics, but I saw so little of myself. I was always liking more of the male characters, too, for that reason. And then I remember I kept getting back on and off again with the wagon reading comics, and the first time I ever saw the second Batgirl, and her whole entire face is covered, I'm like, wow, wouldn't it be great if that character were, like, actually Asian underneath? And then her cowl comes off. I'm like, oh, my God.
She was Asian.
This is the first thing for me. And it's
one Batgirl, Cassandra Cain, was a character of Asian descent. But Cristela wants more.
I am actually creating my own characters. Their stories are a little loose, but I am, like, creating who they are. Which is part of the reason why I really want to participate in this.
Cristela is waiting for a panel on getting into the industry. Because even as the internet has made it more clear that the fans are diverse, character-wise, comics are still
dominated by white male protagonists.
This is David Marquez. He's an artist. In fact, he draws Miles Morales, the Afro-Latino Spider-Man.
As I've become more active in the industry and coming to shows and everything, it's very clear that doesn't reflect the reality of fandom. That doesn't reflect the reality of, you know, the creators. It's a much more diverse culture than perhaps some people would expect.
I don't know what it is, but he said it's really good, and it's all in the story.
You know, coming to shows, I couldn't say how many times I've seen young African-American or Latino readers come up and say, you know, this is a Spider-Man that looks like me, I identify with.
Which has affected his choices.
I've definitely passed up other opportunities to work on other books, and maybe other books that sell more than the Miles Morales series does, but it's specifically the experience of working on the book and, you know, meeting the fans and seeing the impact that the character makes that's made me want to stay on the book. It's something that, it's a feeling that I'm doing something important, doing something that's good.
This is where the internet is invaluable to diversity. It brings this awareness out of the convention halls and takes it everywhere.
Suddenly, the message and control of the message and control of visibility has become much, much more democratic.
Rachel Edidin has worked as a comic book editor. She's also a writer, podcaster, and pop culture journalist.
The biggest shift has been Twitter and Tumblr, public social media. People can speak up and they can organize in ways that aren't geographically oriented and form significant vocal blocks and really stand up and be counted in a way that they weren't before. And it's also a lot easier for them to find and talk directly to creators and to publishers, and a lot easier for creators to reach fans.
And while the social media aspect is new, Rachel insists that the fandom is not.
The idea that we're other, that women, that people of color, that queers aren't part of comics, aren't real in the same way that those dudes in the target demographic are, infuriates me. Because we've been making comics for as long as anybody else. We've been reading comics for as long as anybody else. We're not playing in someone else's sandbox. We are professionals, we are editors, we are writers, we are cartoonists. No one man should
have all that power. In other words, they are comics. Thanks to everyone who spoke to me for that piece, especially the guys you heard at the top. They let me creep up next to them with my microphone amid the mass of people on the convention floor. I just had to know what they were so excited about. Now, those guys may have been having a great time at the con, but for some people, especially women, the convention floor can be a hostile environment. Even though they love comics and games just as fiercely as the men, many women, particularly women of color, who like to cosplay, often face harassment. So I spoke to a few women about why they love to do it and what they're doing to protect themselves and others.
13 is when I was kind of I tried to be cool. It didn't work.
This is Che Grayson. When trying to be cool failed, she put that energy someplace else.
Then I just started reading books constantly. I had a Blockbuster around the corner from my house, huge horror fan, just immersing myself in fiction constantly.
Now that she is 24 years old and studying film at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts, Che makes her own fiction.
The TV series that I am developing is called Misfit Toys. It's about 20-something-year-olds in New York who share one passion, cosplay.
Yes, cosplay. It's short for costume play. You've probably seen pictures online in the days after big comic book conventions like San Diego or New York Comic Con. Cosplayers are the people who dress up as their favorite fictional characters. Cosplayers gather at the cons to meet up and show off their work. They pose for pictures. Some even compete in contests, but that's not the focus for everyone. Besides getting to meet the writers, artists, and actors they love, cons are basically the place for cosplayers to see and be seen. They pull inspiration from television, movies, video games, books, you name it.
Being a part of something, being a loving Doctor Who, loving Super Smash Brothers. So essentially, I developed this series to not only show that love for all of these fandoms, but to create a more realistic face of the people who love them, which include, you know, LGBT and people of color and people of all ages.
Because, Chase says, that's the reality of the fandom. It's diverse, probably more diverse than other places she spends her time.
Literally, every time I do something geek or go somewhere geek, it's the only time I'm not the only black or brown person.
So Che is particularly mindful of this in her own work.
Growing up, I was exposed to white characters who didn't look like me. I was preoccupied with the fact that I didn't look like that. It affected me very much, very, very much.
But luckily, it hasn't stopped Che from cosplaying, from finding characters that she'd like to embody.
Right now, I'm working on Marvin the Martian, which I'm really excited about.
Oh, I'm going to blow it up. It obstructs my view of Venus.
Because even though she makes her own work now, she still wants to play with the things she loves.
I loved Looney Tunes. How am I going to feel being dressed as Marvin the Martian? You know what I mean? So it's literally chasing after that feeling of euphoria and reimagining that experience you have when you're actually exposed to that work.
Hi, my name is Shaka Cumberbatch. I am a freelance writer and a cosplayer. There are very few hobbies, I feel, where you can really, like, not only create something, but, like, embody that creation as well, and then go to, like, a convention or a gathering around other people who have also embodied their creation. Through cosplay, I've made just incredible friends, like, lifelong friends. I mean, I'm getting married next year, and two of my bridesmaids I met through cosplay.
This past February, Shaka and some other cosplayers got together to create 28 Days of Black Cosplay, an online celebration of black cosplayers on platforms like Twitter and Tumblr. It was, in part, a response to the fact that many cosplayers of color, particularly black cosplayers, often have people
tell us, like, oh, you can't cosplay that character because she doesn't look like you. That character's white and you're black.
The response to 28 Days of Black Cosplay was overwhelmingly positive, but it did have its detractors.
People were telling us, like, oh, like, the fact that you're talking about the fact that you're black is just making me uncomfortable because I am not also black. Like, you're drawing attention to the fact that we don't look the same, and that's very threatening to me. You know, like, you can tell us that we're black, but if we start talking about being black, like, then it's a problem. It's like, whoa. I don't know. I think that sometimes when people aren't a part of a group and they see that group coming together and celebrating each other, they start to feel, like, weirdly threatened by it.
Shaka has also had negative experiences that weren't based on race. In 2013, Shaka was one of many female cosplayers attending the anime convention AKON who were targeted on Twitter by a group calling itself the Grope Crew. And sometimes even
the Rape Crew. Yeah.
The Twitter users claimed they were also at the Dallas, Texas convention.
I was freaked out because they were telling me, like, they knew where I was. They're like, oh, you know, I see you standing in the line and, like, I'm tweeting you from in line too and I'm going to come find you later tonight.
Some even tweeted at her that they knew what hotel room she was staying in and that they would find her there later.
So AKON security, to their credit, took it very seriously. You know, they contacted each of us personally and they let us know that they were, like, investigating the threats. We did get the Dallas Police Department involved. We got Twitter involved as well.
But not everyone took the threat seriously.
A lot of people were like, oh, you guys are just, like, you know, overreacting. It's just a joke. It's whatever. And I was like, it's not just a joke. I don't get how it's funny to scare people and tell them you're going to find them and rape them in the night. It's very silencing when that happens, because a lot of people are like, they're obviously trolling, don't feed the trolls, that's what they want. And it's like, okay, so what are you supposed to do? Not take it seriously and end up getting dragged into, like, an alleyway or something? Like, you know, you can't win either way.
For me, it starts with the discovery process.
This is Elizabeth Schweitzer.
So when I see something new for the first time, there's this moment of, aha, that's what I'm going to cosplay. So once I've made that decision, I start researching.
Cosplay is a huge part of Elizabeth's life.
TV shows, I won't get past episode 3 if I don't see somebody I want to cosplay, if it's fiction. When you're in costume, you're basically wearing a giant sign that says, this is what I'm passionate about, this is what I'm into.
cosplay makes Elizabeth feel powerful.
From being in middle school and high school and being super socially awkward and shy, having that level of comfort where you could just approach anybody and feel safe being yourself and geeking out with them, it was like a revelation to me.
And on the one hand, that vulnerability can be a great thing.
So it was the first chance I really had to be myself, which is, I guess, kind of weird considering I was acting in character at the time.
But on the other hand,
I have been sexually harassed in costume from 14 on up.
When Elizabeth was 14, she did her first cosplay as the male character Luffy from the anime show One Piece. Someone came up to her and without warning kissed her, putting their tongue in her mouth. It was the first in a long line of unwanted touches and comments.
I was trying to figure out what it was about me and my demeanor or my behavior that was causing this to happen. And after a while, I realized that I wasn't alone and that there was nothing in particular I was doing to invite the behavior. I thought, this is my safe place. Conventions are where I go to feel safe and to feel happy, and I'm not going to let this happen.
Elizabeth decided to start the Consent Project.
So I was going to go talk to other cosplayers about what experiences they've had and take a photo of them holding a sign that says cosplay is not consent, or let them write in whatever they wanted. My costume is not an invitation. Did I say you could touch me? Basically anything that came to mind that they wanted to express to the people that had harassed them.
Other cosplayers started sharing the photos online. Blogs wrote about it. Some comic book writers tweeted about it.
And it just blew up. Apparently it resonated with a lot of people around the world.
Over the last couple of years, cosplayers and other fans have gotten more outspoken. And it's made a difference. Some conventions have put policies in place to address this and other forms of harassment. Last year at New York Comic Con, there were signs that read cosplay is not consent everywhere. Elizabeth is quick to acknowledge how many voices went into making these changes possible. That she did not create the term cosplay is not consent herself. But she's proud of her role in keeping her community a place where cosplayers like her can do what they love.
If you asked me a couple years ago if I thought I would be able to walk into a convention and see cosplay does not equal consent and think that I had something to do with it, I don't think I would have believed you, but it's all over the place now. And even more importantly, I'm just so glad that it's finally getting the attention that it's needed and that things are changing for the better so that people in costume can feel safe going to these conventions, which is really all they've wanted to begin with.
Thanks to Che Grayson, Shaka Cumberbatch, and Elizabeth Schweitzer for sharing your stories. Now, I've never done cosplay myself, but I often wonder what I would dress up as if I did. I think I'd want to do something hyper-realistic, like maybe I'd dress up like Rod Serling or Celia Cruz. Who knows? You know, you can be a geek about almost anything. A listener sent us this voice memo.
My name is Reggie Wade, and I'm a Black and Latino geek. I am a political junkie and nerd. I love watching debates and speeches. I watch presidential debates like I watch the Super Bowl. I even watch old debates on YouTube just for fun. I don't remember what I had for breakfast 2 days ago, but I remember who moderated the 1992 vice presidential debate. It was Al Bruno. So that's my geekiness, and take it easy, guys.
Gotta love a politics nerd. Thanks, Reggie. When we come back on Latino USA...
This industry is now catching up on comic book and geek culture. It's been there. It's been diverse.
A hip-hop legend sets the record straight. But first, we hear from fantasy and science fiction authors. Hey, since you're listening to this especially geeky episode of Latino USA, I think you'll really like NPR's newest podcast, Hidden Brain. On the latest episode, Shankar Vedantam looks at the consequences of near misses and the surprising way these losses can motivate us. Plus, country singer Kacey Musgraves joined Shankar to talk about her new album and play a game of Mad Scientist. So don't miss it. Listen now on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, working to improve the quality of people's lives by supporting the performing arts, the environment, medical research, and child well-being. Information is available at ddcf.org. And American Jewish World Service, working for 30 years to end poverty and advance human rights worldwide. Learn more at ajws.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Daisy Rosario, in for Maria Hinojosa. Today we are talking about diversity within nerd or geek culture, or as I like to call it, geekdom. We've heard from a mix of creators and fans about their passion and their experiences, but when it came to talking about fantasy and science fiction, I went straight to some authors to hear about their experiences in publishing. Chances are you've seen The Lord of the Rings. Every child you've met in the last 10 years has likely read Harry Potter, and whether you're a fan or not, you can probably answer some basic questions about both Star Wars and Star Trek. But you might not know what's happening in that world right now. So I asked someone right in the thick of it what's going on. Here's Nora Jemison.
Science fiction and fantasy are going through the same changes that the rest of the American mediascape and political landscape and whatever are going through. There is the sudden awareness that one particular kind of voice, that of straight white men, has dominated discussion and creation and publication and so on. A sort of sea change has been happening all along, but we're reaching critical mass.
That change is largely thanks to social media, but the internet didn't introduce Nora to these genres. She's been into this stuff since she was a kid.
Science fiction stories are the power fantasies of the geek. You know, and I think that was what I was getting out of it was, you know, I kind of felt like the kid who was ostracized for being the one that liked to read. And yet in these other stories, people who liked to read and had no interest in sports could be the hero. And I think I needed that.
Eventually, she found direct inspiration.
But it was really, again, seeing Octavia Butler's books that told me I can do this in science fiction and fantasy. Because up to that point, I had seen only Black writers publishing Black books, only books that came out through African-American interest-focused presses, sold in the dark shelves in the back of the bookstore. And that was really all I'd seen, that and, like, Toni Morrison.
Nora went from writing as a hobby to entertaining the possibility of being a professional writer.
First, I was writing bog-standard science fiction and fantasy featuring stalwart white men going forth and doing stalwart white guy things. It was really only about in my mid-20s I started realizing there's something wrong with that. And I started to suddenly question, what's going on? Why is it that I have such trouble having fun in color?
Despite being a woman of color, she struggled to write characters that looked like her.
Well, yeah, everyone who grows up inculcated in a racist and sexist genre is going to have to work against that actively and consciously in order to make something that works. And it's going to feel wrong at first because that's not what we're used to.
When Nora started trying to get published, she got a certain kind of feedback.
Not sure how to relate to this. Not sure who the audience for this would be.
I love this writing and I love the story. I just don't really identify with the character. My name is Daniel Jose Older. I'm a writer, an editor, and a composer. The code in that language is saying, oh, your people don't read. The truth is we read. We read a lot. We love science fiction. We love fantasy. And we love to read.
If the industry doesn't see Latinos and other people of color as readers, maybe it's because it already has a hard time seeing them as people. Take, for example, something that often happens to Nalo Hopkinson. She's an award-winning science fiction and fantasy writer born in the Caribbean.
When I write in Caribbean English, very often the editor wants to correct it. And not to standard English, but to their understanding of Black American English. But they don't have a sense that Black people speak differently in different parts of, you know, America, much less different parts of the world.
And if you agree with Nora Jemison, the fact that the gatekeepers of the media don't know the difference does have an effect on what the general population understands.
We get our sense of empathy from media, from literature. We see and are encouraged to empathize with certain kinds of characters. And we are encouraged to know what they're feeling and guess at what's going on inside their heads. We're not given that encouragement for certain kinds of characters.
Daniel Jose Older again.
And we have to have this conversation about what does it do to the psyche of a culture, you know, of an entire people, both for folks of color looking at that and, you know, seeing that they can't be we can't be our own saviors. And then to white people seeing that their role again and again is to save the world.
Hopkinson sees what it does to young people. She's a creative writing professor at the University of California, Riverside, and still has family and friends in the Caribbean.
We have a family friend who's a writer who's also a professor who's been teaching for quite some time. And she says she'll get students, she's in Trinidad in the Caribbean, she'll get students who want to write science fiction fantasy who don't set it anywhere. They feel that they cannot use the places they know. And it breaks my heart that people feel like they have no place.
The messages come from every direction, even critically acclaimed shows. Here's Daniel.
Yeah, I love Game of Thrones, but when we see the Khaleesi be the savior, the white savior character, that is an old trope, that is a cliche. We're tired of that. It's boring.
When these authors, and also fans, try to address the issue, they get pushback. But for Daniel, Nora, and Nalo, it's not just about getting people to see their faces. It's about recognizing which faces are always there.
We're trying to get people to tell more in-depth stories, create more real, authentic characters, and do it right, and do it respectfully. We're asking people to recognize the full humanity of people of color.
And also to get people to see that it's not just about good intentions. Nalo.
The other thing I encounter is people saying, well, why are you so focused on what race these writers are? I read everything. I don't pay attention to the race of the writer, so I must not be racist. All right, for a game, just for now, look at your shelves. Find out the races of the writers on those shelves. I bet you most of them will be white. That's not because you're deliberately selecting for them. You don't have to.
All three agreed that if it were up to them, they would just be writers. But it's not that simple.
I don't see how I could not engage it to some extent, because I feel like if I didn't, there would be no place for me. I mean, Black, female, queer, disabled, increasingly middle-aged. I've been needing to make space for me and mine from the beginning.
Which makes sense for writers in this genre. Just look at the works of Philip K. Dick, or Rod Serling, or J.K. Rowling, who all took on themes of politics, bigotry, and personal identity.
The weird thing about science fiction fantasy is that, in a way, it's already dealing with these issues. It is a literature that is about fighting back against state control, meeting the other, and what happens at that meeting. And yet, it's being a real struggle to get the genre to straight up deal with the fact that people do this every day and that there's nothing wrong with putting it in our books.
Both writers and readers are working together to be heard.
There's a lot of crossover between social justice and sci-fi, and it's going to be more and more because of places like Twitter, because we're having these conversations and we're coming closer together and our voices are becoming unified in a way that they never had before.
But that doesn't mean that the fandom itself is new. Nora Jemison again.
We've been here all along. We never were not here. It's just finally being acknowledged.
Thanks to N.K. Jemison, Daniel Jose Older, and Nalo Hopkinson for speaking with me. Daniel Jose Older's book, Shadow Shaper, received rave reviews. The New York Times called it magnificent and said, this is a world that readers cannot help wanting to live in. Creating worlds is one of the things that makes geekdom so magical. Recently, a hip-hop legend decided to jump in and create a world as well. Now, when I started putting these stories together, one thing that really struck me was how everyone I spoke to was saying some version of, we are not new to being geeks. It's just that no one knew we were here. And I can think of no better way to show that than by having one of the first superstars of hip-hop explain what he loves about comic books and why he chose to start making his own.
When I was a young man growing up, you said one line, and I was like, yo, this is my dude. DMC, I can draw.
Yeah. That was 85, too.
At a panel on hip-hop and comic books at New York Comic Con, one panelist points out that DMC of Run DMC has always loved to draw.
Yeah, I caught it.
Because I could have said, I'm DMC, I can rap. I said, I'm DMC, I can draw.
And was bragging about it, too.
Yeah, like, you know, DJ Russ, I'm DMC, I can draw.
Like we said before, we rap hardcore. I'm DJ Run, I can scratch. I'm DMC, I can draw. And now we got finesse.
Yo, yo, what's up? This is DMC and the place to be, a.k.a. Daryl McDaniels, the king of rock.
The place to be, the Latino USA studio in Harlem. See, before he was the king of rock, known to the world as the DMC in Run DMC, Daryl McDaniels was a comic book fan. And now he's created his own publishing company, Daryl Makes Comics, and is putting out his own comic book, perfectly titled DMC.
I was the kid that had my comic books, took tracing paper, and wanted to draw all the Marvel superheroes and Batman and Superman. And then by 6 years old, I think I started drawing, you know, the tracing paper thing around 5 years old. But by 6 and 7 years old, I was able to move the tracer paper and just draw Captain America, Hulk, Marvel was my thing.
As new influences came into his life, McDaniel still saw things through the lens of comics.
As a kid, you put your blanket on your neck and you pretend you're Batman and Superman. When hip-hop first came to Queens, from the Bronx and from Manhattan, all the kids wanted to be Flash, Melly Mel, and Bambada. It wasn't a showbiz thing. So all the kids wanted to get turntables. All the kids wanted to be their favorite superhero breakdancers like Rocksteady. Everything hip-hop was graffiti, DJing, MCing, the style. We wanted to be those B-boys and B-girls were our superheroes.
Comics also made him a better student.
What I learned in school, in history, World War II, come home, Captain America would take me to World War II. What I learned about science and geology and social studies, I would come home and Iron Man and the Avengers and Deathlok, you know, robotics and science, Marvel Comics would take me there.
And that wasn't the only place that Marvel Comics took him.
I lived in New York City, Queens, but I didn't get to go to Manhattan. I didn't get to go to the Bronx. Marvel Comics was cooler than DC because it would show me places in New York that I wasn't allowed to go. I was one of those kids. You be in this house when that sun going down. So I never got to go to 42nd Street or Park Avenue. Do you know the Avengers Mansion was in Central Park? You know, so Marvel took me to all these places.
The stories and the superheroes in comics also gave McDaniels his confidence.
When you think about a comic book, yeah, the Invincible Iron Man, the Incredible Hulk. When I stepped to the microphone, I didn't just become DMC. I became the devastating mic-controlling DMC.
McDaniels even remembers renaming Jam Master Jay. Originally, Jam Master Jay was going by Jazzy Jay, but there was already a Jazzy Jay, and you just can't do that.
I said, Jay, give me a minute. Went home, sat down, went into my creative comic book world and said, okay, his name is Jay. He can't be Grandmaster. The jam is a record. Hey, DJ, play my favorite jam. But the jam is also the party. Yo, man, that jam last night was great. This is comic book mind. Jay is going to be the jam master because he's the master of it all. And you got to know, I saw Jay the next day. I said, Jay, you ready? Here's your name. And he was like, what is it? Jazzy Jason. I said, no, you're going to be the jam master, Jay. He was like, wow. I am the Jam Master Jay. And think about it. That name was so original, so unique. But that labeling came from comic books.
The editor-in-chief of Daryl Makes Comics, or DMC's company, is experienced art director and fellow hip-hop head slash comic book geek, Edgardo Miranda Rodriguez.
When we wanted to make this comic book, hip-hop was going to be in the comic book, but it had to be organic. In fact, the word hip-hop is never even written or mentioned once in a comic book because it's just organic. Why is it organic? Because it's coming from our experience. We grew up in New York City, so organically the story's going to feel, smell, look like hip-hop. Organically, it's also going to be culturally diverse because that was our reality. We didn't grow up in just one segmented Black or Latino or Asian or white neighborhood. It was a mix.
This industry is now catching up on comic book and geek culture. It's been there. It's been diverse. The industry's also disrespectful to the capability of different people, but also our Black people and Latino people to discuss, comprehend, and relate to current issues. You know what I'm saying? It's almost like, you know, when it comes to racism and poverty and stuff like that, they don't let us talk, especially if we're younger than 40 years old.
And while it may still be hard to be heard, Miranda Rodriguez thinks that now is the time for this book.
We couldn't have done this book 10 years ago or 20 years ago, and definitely not 30 years ago when Run DMC first came out. We need to make this book now. Not saying we live in a new race-conscious America just because we have an African-American president. No. I feel like right now America is like a buffet. I think for the longest, we've been kind of like, America's been more like a TV dinner under aluminum foil. When we unwrap it, we see what's actually for dinner. But now America is becoming more of a buffet. When you walk into the dining hall, you see everything, the good and the bad.
Daryl DMC McDaniels hopes that through this book, he can do for another generation what the arts did for him.
Hip-hop didn't start with rappers alike. But before it was on a record, there was a whole era of creativity that was going on. And that era, that creativity, the pop culture of comic books, kung fu movies, and hip hop was powerful enough to inspire and educate a young Catholic school kid. And it changed my life.
It's hard to find people with half as much energy as DMC. I've since seen him at a few conventions, and he was just as excited to talk to comic book fans as they were to meet him. We here at Latino USA also wanted to hear from the average fan. So for today's Sabiduría, we turn to one of our listeners who sent in this voice memo.
Hi, my name is Christina Martinez. I'm from Sacramento, California. I'm a teacher, a mother of four, an avid writer and reader, and a young parent advocate. I'm also apparently a geek. I never really thought of myself that way as I was growing up. I just always considered my interests maybe a little different from what the mainstream kids were into. And now that I'm raising my own kids and they're taking on the same interests as well, for instance, we're just preparing for our annual Lord of the Rings marathon that we do every fall. It's interesting to watch now my children taking on the same interests that I have that kind of set me apart as a child. I recall when everybody else was reading Babysitter's Club, I was reading The Last Unicorn, anything nature or science. Eventually, I kind of learned to hide some of my interests because I would get teased for it. And now I just, you know, I'm just proud.
Thank you, Christina Martinez, for sending us that voice memo. We loved hearing from you. Can I please come visit for next year's Lord of the Rings viewing? It's so very nice to get to share your passions with the people you love. And on that note, I want to dedicate this show to three people who were dearly loved and who the world recently lost. Cecilia Weissman was a geek about journalism and helping young journalists find their voice. She was also the best friend to our host, Maria Hinojosa. Mike Klein was a geek about horse racing, as well as the best friend to our executive director, Maria Chaveco. And Jeannie Trocobalvin was one of the best friends I ever had in my life. She was a gringa who was a geek about Latino culture. I will miss you always, Jeannie, and I will never forget nerding out with you about Homestar Runner, or you teaching me about Shakira before she went blonde. That's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by me, Daisy Rosario, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Antonia Cerejido, Julia Alsop, and Sarah Barrett. Julia Hsu is our production assistant. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Janice Yamoka, Gabriela Sierra Alonso, and Maggie Freeling. Nancy Trujillo makes every single thing happen. You have no idea. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I've been your guest host. I'm also senior producer of Latino USA, and I'm proud to sit in for our executive producer and host, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And of course, you gotta check us out on Instagram.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Kung Fu reminded me of, like, The Last Dragon, and they're like...
I love that movie. That's one of my favorites. I ran into Timac on the L train, and I was like, yo, what are you, a vampire? You never age, man.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cigna, a global health service company dedicated to helping people improve their health, well-being, and sense of security at Cigna.com. And the Arcus Foundation, dedicated to the idea that people can live in harmony with one another and the natural world. Learn more about Arcus and its partners at arcusfoundation.org. This is NPR.